Edutainment Learning is powered by Academica Virtual Education and Collegia TV. For more information, visit www.edutainmentlearning.com.
My name is Rita McGrath. I'm a professor at the Columbia Business School in the city of New York, and I've been teaching there for quite a long time. I joined Columbia in 1993. Before that, I was doing my PhD at the Wharton School. It's part of the University of Pennsylvania. And before that, I was working as an IT director doing what today we would call a digital transformation. So that's been my professional career since getting my undergraduate degree, which I did at Barnard College in New York. And I have a master in public administration from Columbia's School of International and Public Affairs.
You mind if we just jump right into some student questions? Because I got a lot emailed to me this fall and I got some emailed to me this morning. So one of our kids wanted to know what drew you to business initially?
Well, I think my parents were scientists, and my dad worked for Kodak at one point, and he worked for Xerox before that. And he was always coming home with stories about what was going on at the office and who said what. And so I think what drew me initially to business was the human angle that, you know, I mean, businesses are really just organizations of human beings put together to try to accomplish some specific goals. And I thought, I always find that really super interesting. Then when I did this digital transformation work that I was alluding to, I got very interested in large-scale organizational change, even though it was a public sector setting. But, you know, many of the phenomena are very similar across different ranges of endeavor.
So one of our kids wanted to know, how have you seen technology transform the business industry back from the 80s into the 90s with the birth of the internet and technology?
Oh, it's been huge. It's been absolutely huge. And one of the best answers to that is actually in a Harvard Business Review article that just came out. It's in the January-February edition, in which my colleague and I write about something we call the permissionless organization. So if you go all the way back to the 80s, right, people would be writing things on paper and they'd be printing things out and you'd have sort of written documentation. When you started to get into the late 80s, early 90s, you started to have dumb terminals connected to mainframe computers. And then with the microprocessor revolution, when you started to have actual personal computers, you could start to do things with spreadsheets and with word processors that you could never do before. So what it's done is a couple of things. It's accelerated the pace that you can do things at. It's also, though, changed the nature of the kind of tasks people do at work. So a lot of what managers do today would have been handled by assistants, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. So responding to correspondence, keeping track of files, you know, archiving materials, there would have been armies of secretaries and other kinds of assistants to do that work. Today, it's all sitting on the desk of your typical manager. And I think that's a real change, whether it's a change for the better or a change for the worse, I'm not sure. But it certainly is a very different environment that we're playing with today.
Yeah, and with the introduction of artificial intelligence, I can only imagine where it's going to be. And I know that you're both a businesswoman as well as an innovator. So we'll touch on Valise in a second. One of the kids wanted to know, how does an idea come from fruition into action in your industry?
In education or?
In business. So like you have an idea for a business, how would you describe bringing that into reality?
Oh, well, it depends on the context. So if it's a startup idea, right, then depending on what it is and how much resource you need to get it going, you can start it yourself. I mean, if you wanted to start a lemonade stand or a transcribing business, you probably don't need a lot of investment to make that happen. If it's a more substantive idea and you need to get the support of other people, typically what'll happen is you'll have a series of what we call funding rounds. So the first round is typically what they call friends, fools, and family, who give you a few resources just to get going. But then once you get into the world of venture capital, you know, venture-backed startups, you'll have a whole series of different rounds where they call them A, B, C, D, and it's different levels of investors that come in as your business starts to scale. So that would be one path. If you're in a company, let's say it's an idea for something that your company could provide, every company has a different way of managing it. I think the very best provides some Slack resources for people to experiment, for people to fool around at a kind of a low level. So in the best companies, it's really easy to get started with an idea that you have and do some experiments and then bring others along and see if they can support what you're doing.
Speaking of talking about bringing ideas into reality, can you discuss a little bit about your work with Valise, where it came from, and a little bit about the history of the trajectory?
Yeah, so Valise really got its start by my desire to see more companies adopt the ideas and have more impact. And the name actually came from the heart and soul of the idea is, how do you manage portfolios of opportunities? So how do you manage many ideas, many projects all at once? And I couldn't think of anything more boring than calling something a portfolio management approach. And then I got to thinking, well, artists have portfolios, you know, and they carry their artwork in a valise with an S. And I thought, oh, well, if I change the S to a Z, the cool way, you know, people do, valise could be a great name. I looked it up and there was nobody else that had it. And it also sort of evokes value realized. And so the goal of valise, as opposed to what I do personally, is to really scale and make very practical these tools and ideas that I've been developing.
That's great. And I have that in the chat and you guys check that out. That's a really neat website if you're interested in innovations and in business. One of the kids, they wanted to know, how do you juggle personal with professional with being so successful? Like, how do you prioritize that throughout such a successful career?
Well, it's always a struggle. And I think one thing to realize is you're always going to be out of balance, right? I mean, there's always going to be something that's tugging at you, something that's urgent, something that needs attention. What I think really helps is chunking things up so that you don't take on these enormous tasks all at once, but you say, okay, this week, you know, here's the top 3 to 5 things I really need to get done. The other thing I would say just about me is I'm very big on closure. Like, I like to bring things to a conclusion, not to let them linger. So I think that's another important way that you can keep work from overtaking your life and your life from overtaking your work. But it's always going to be a challenge. And certainly if you're in a situation where you've got young kids at home or parents you're taking care of, or, you know, a lot of other personal demands on your time, it's going to cut into something, whether it's sleep or exercise or time with your friends. You may have to make some tough choices about how you're really going to spend your time.
And that's great advice, especially nowadays. I know there's a lot of kids trying to persevere through adversity. Mm-hmm. So one of our kids, they wanted to know, if you had to choose one accomplishment, professional accomplishment, out of everything that you've done, what is the one that you are most proud of?
Professionally?
Yes.
Well, I'd have to say it was beginning with some ideas that I published in the mid-90s. So we're going back quite a ways, around how do you plan under conditions of high uncertainty? And it was called discovery-driven planning. And it really led to the commercialization of the whole lean startup movement. It's now part of the way a lot of companies do this kind of planning. I still think there's a lot more to do with it. But if I had to sort of say something that really was one of my initial big successes, that would be it.
That is some great, great advice, or a great comment on that. We have a question from Regina, and Regina, you should be able to unmute. You had a very nice question. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hello. So my question is, how do you keep your company profitable, but at the same time make your products accessible for people?
That's a great question. Well, the company right now operates with 3 kinds of offerings. So the first is what I call advisory, and that's where a lot of the profits right now are coming from. So this would be giving advice to great big companies, you know, and it's expensive for them. So that helps offset the other products that we've been developing. So the other products have to do with learning, on-demand learning, as well as tools and diagnostics. So essentially what happens is the advisory to some extent subsidizes the more accessible offerings.
That is Great advice. I know I see some students here in the video taking notes. So this is awesome. So we'll go with a couple more questions, then we'll let you go. But one of the kids wanted to know, what advice would you give to us who want to come to America and study business? What kind of advice would you give to them?
Well, it depends where you are in your journey. So if you wanted to come in as an undergraduate, then the obvious choice would be to find a school with a business curriculum and apply and get in on a student visa. I'm not actually sure that's the best path to take if you want to do your undergraduate. I think it's useful to get some experience first. Another way is to apply for an internship. And I can give you an example of how that worked in my life. So I got right around the beginning of the pandemic, I got a letter from a young lady named Helena Trentino, who is studying a combination of fashion design and business at Hult University. And she was in San Francisco, but she was based in Italy. And she said she'd like to do an internship with me. One of her professors had strongly recommended my work. And I said, you know, I'm just not set up to support interns. She said, oh no, I'll be in Italy. It'll be virtual. And I was like, okay, we can do that. So I think if you find a couple of either executives or professors or people that you think are really interesting because you're interested in their work or what they've accomplished, there's absolutely no harm reaching out to them and asking if you can get your hand in doing some projects or something like that for them. So Helena's still with me. She's got a full-time job now in Italy, but she works for me part-time. And her sister, Flaminia, who's also based in Italy, is full-time with me.
I know we have a lot of Italians on the call, so you're in good company here. We will ask a couple more questions of you, and then we will let you go. But they wanted to know, where do you see the influence of artificial intelligence when it comes to innovation in business? Do you see it having a good or a positive influence, or are you just not sure yet?
Well, it's a tool, you know, and any tool can be used well or it can be used badly. I think one of the misconceptions about artificial intelligence is that it's going to replace human creativity because it only knows the past. And we forget that, right? So an AI system is only as good as the data it's been trained on. And so if you're looking for novel and creative solutions to new kinds of problems, AI can help you sort through some of the patterns, right? It can help you do some of the grunt work, but it's not going to come up with a novel solution. And I think that's something very important to remember.
Yes, I agree. Human creativity, number one. So before we let you go, our final question, I ask this of all of our guests. And guys, we have a lot of amazing guests coming up. Check them out on the website that's in the chat, edutainmentlearning.com. So before we let you go, what kind of advice would you have for these kids as they go out in the world? And even if they don't want to go into business or innovation or management, what kind of advice would you have for them as someone who is so accomplished in her industry? As they kind of figure out what kind of path they want to carve.
Yeah, I think the most important thing to think about is lifelong learning, right? Which is you want to adopt what is commonly known as a growth mindset. And what that means is you're not looking at yourself as being good at math, right? You're looking at yourself as, well, I'm not as good as I'd like to be at math yet. And I think that's super important because I think sometimes with the way that we train young people, you get put in these boxes, right? Oh, so-and-so is great at English or so-and-so is good at that. And I think what it does is it makes you fearful of trying new things and of learning. And remember, anytime you're going to try to learn something new, you're not going to be very good at it yet. But it's the yet that matters, right? So that would be my encouragement, which is really think about learning over the course of your life.
Well, Dr. McGrath, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today. Before I end the meeting for all, I'm going to allow everyone to say thank you to Dr. McGrath, and we wish you the best, and we're rooting for you. Definitely check out felice.com. So thank you so much, Dr. McGrath.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. McGrath.
Thank you.